I'm Kate Raphael on KPFA Women's Magazine. A little later today, I'll be talking to two organizers of a union drive at Hastings College of the Law in San Francisco. But first, let's learn a bit about the history of clerical worker organizing with Professor Linda Blum. Ms. Blum is the author of Between Feminism and Labor, The Significance of the Movement for Comparable Worth, which focused on one strategy for closing the gender wage gap between pink-collar and blue-collar workers. Between Feminism and Labor examined two Bay Area movements, one in San Jose and the other in Contra Costa County, both of which created new alliances between feminists and the labor movement. Ms. Blum got her PhD from Cal, taught at the University of New Hampshire for many years, and currently is Associate Professor of Sociology at Northeastern University. But she started out as an office worker herself.
You know, I spent a year in typing in eighth grade and was up to 60 words per minute on an old, before there were even electric typewriters.
So when you were doing that, did you have a consciousness that you would probably move into something else, or did that come later?
Oh, I think later. In high school, my mother became very politicized, you know, in the anti-Vietnam War movement and fair housing movements in our area, sort of an outgrowth of the civil rights movement, and then started learning about women's liberation, as we used to call it then, and that's when I think my ideas started changing. And, of course, there really weren't many opportunities for women. So I think my aspirations just evolved really when I was in school. And I was taking a lot of clerical jobs to put myself through school. And I mean, to be honest, I think that I felt that the other women I met, their lives were really very depressing. To be honest, it kind of scared me that I might end up like them.
So your book, Between Feminism and Labor, which is focusing on the struggle for comparable worth in the Bay Area and beyond, came out in 1991, and it looks at movements in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. And you suggested there that the labor movement needed to pay more attention to gender and feminism needed to be more conscious of class issues in order for either to effectively mobilize low-wage working women, which at that time meant largely, or at least significantly, clerical women, clerical workers. So now, nearly 20 years later, how would you assess how both of those movements rose to that challenge?
So much has changed. Unfortunately, you know, not a lot of it that good. I mean, I think that to be fair to both movements, they've taken a lot of sucker punches. You know, we've had 20 years of really conservative, neoliberal restructuring of government, of our economy. These are just very big blows to the labor movement and to feminist movements. So if I could revise your question, I think I would say that considering all of the conservative retrenchment and the undoing of the gains made for labor and for feminism, I think the movements are doing well, but it's such a difficult time, and there have been so many serious blows. I think that they're both much more fractured, weakened movements than where we had been. One thing I had mentioned in the book is that we were going to be seeing more class differences dividing women, and we've definitely seen that. That's huge now, that many women, I'd include myself, really rode the gains from the feminist movement, and there's a huge number now in elite professions, in management positions. So there are fewer women who are in office jobs than there had been 20 years ago.
Although it's still, according to statistics that I just looked at from, I think, 2005, about 30% of women workers are secretaries or administrative assistants. It's still the largest
right.
proportion of women workers, like the highest concentration of women workers.
And then, you know, we're so much more into the service economy, this kind of what experts call kind of casualization of the labor force. So there are, you know, many more, I guess, kind of problems when you think about the overall sort of look of the low-wage workforce.
You analyze in your book two examples of organizing among populations of primarily women workers, mainly clerical workers, both here in the Bay Area. One was a strike among San Jose city workers, and that, you said, was the first strike for comparable worth or pay equity between women's and men's jobs anywhere in the country. And I had never heard about that strike until I ran across your book. So could you tell us a little about that?
The context was just so different than today. I mean, I'm not surprised that you hadn't heard of it. I don't think that many of my students would be able to really relate to this, because it was a time when, you know, it was a very new thing to have women elected into top elected officials.
And when was this?
In the late 70s, interesting things started happening in the city of San Jose. There was a group, City Women for Advancement, and Title IX, say the full enforcement of Title IX and of Title VII, which were passed in the early 70s, was sort of being felt. So women in San Jose, clerical women, but led by librarians and recreation workers. So some women, you know, with a bit more education, women with college degrees, were starting to feel they could move into these kind of leadership, different kinds of leadership positions. But many of the clericals were still frustrated and felt like their mobility was blocked. They didn't want to move into men's jobs, you know, but they wanted to be paid decently. And so there's kind of an interesting coalition of clerical workers, probably many of whom hadn't gone to college, with librarians and recreation workers who had, combined in this union effort to look at the inequities between women's jobs and men's jobs in city employment. And so they developed what's called a job evaluation to measure the skills and the responsibilities in their different jobs, and felt that they should be paid what, you know, at least what maintenance workers were made. And they had some success getting involved to make these inequities visible through the study. And so this strike was, I think, in 1980. It was only 9 days, but it did get a lot of media attention. They were called the feminist capital of the country and things like that.
So what happened? Did they win or did they lose, or did they win some stuff and lose some stuff?
They did win quite a bit. What I thought was very positive is the level of grassroots participation. Ordinary working woman getting involved in this, and something that they hadn't seen themselves as a feminist before. Some of the other big pay equity cases were very top-down. That is, it was elite women and men in higher positions kind of saying, oh, this is something we should do. It wasn't women working in these jobs, in these office jobs themselves, mobilizing and carrying out these changes.
So looking at that case and also others that you may be familiar with over the years, how would you say that organizing office workers and other groups of primarily women workers is different from organizing in sectors that are more heavily male?
That's a great question. I mean, I think a lot of the successful work organizing women office workers has, since, you know, these cases that I studied, have really thought about that more and more. And so they've really strategized around that. And so there have been some really big successes organizing office workers in big universities, some elite universities on the East Coast, Harvard, Yale, Columbia. Harvard was in 88, I think, was their first big contract, and Yale was a bit after that, and then Columbia in the 90s. And those unions have thrived and have particularly said we need to have different strategies. It's not that women are different than men, just innately. Like sometimes people say, oh, women have different values. Women just have different orientations than men, just biologically or something. Like we're not competitive and, you know, we're more caring. And I'm not sure if that's really true. Or I sort of don't buy it because I think there's so many women are so different individually and men are so different individually. But as a sociologist, I think about it in terms of the way the job shapes what, you know, how you would think and act. And certainly these jobs are shaping people in different ways than sort of the traditional male on the factory floor, all these guys working together. Because, you know, many times you can have, you know, like at Harvard, you've got something like close to 5,000 in their union, yet they're working scattered, you know, many in small offices. It's hard to have a sense of community when you're working, you know, all over the organization and not in large groups. And where you might feel loyalty to the larger organization, you might have a quite personal relationship with managers and other professionals. Sometimes people say there's an intimacy in the office. Mm-hmm. So one, it would be hard to organize on an adversarial model, not because women aren't capable of being adversarial, but because it doesn't fit their experience, their day-to-day experience at work, which may be quite friendly, except they just wish their, you know, paychecks were bigger or their or they had more sick leave or, you know, better daycare and so on.
Or didn't have to run errands for the boss's wife.
Right. There have been these successes in organizing, and it's very slow. I think Harvard, it took 17 years of organizing.
No.
But they specifically said, you know, we're about community building. We're about having a voice in the workplace rather than just here to be adversarial. We're here to think about all kinds of issues, family issues, as well as just bread and butter issues. They do a lot with empowering women and others in the union to negotiate for themselves as well. They try to do a lot of mediation instead of sort of traditional grievance procedures. And I think that, you know, employing organizations are just as viciously anti-union as they've always been in the U.S. society. I know when I was working at University of New Hampshire for 12 years, and the clerical workers there were and are trying to organize. We received, as faculty, we were unionized. We received many threatening memos. I was head of the Women's Studies program, so I suppose I was seen as management for a time, that we should make sure that clericals under our management, you know, weren't communicating about union activities or organizing activities at all during the working day, that nothing happened on university premises, that, you know, they couldn't use any university means of communication and all these kinds of issues.
Some years ago, I was involved in a pretty spectacularly unsuccessful effort to start some organizing. And I got the sense from the union staff we talked to at that time that they saw office workers in the private sector as essentially unorganizable. Have you observed that kind of bias in the labor movement? And do you think that it has any basis in fact? Like, are office workers more difficult to organize than other workers?
I mean, the idea that women office workers are unorganizable has long historical roots. It goes back to the first, you know, bringing women into office work back at the turn of the 20th century. It has a lot to do with the way that, I mean, the work was structured to create this docile, you know, and relatively inexpensive labor force. So, I mean, I don't think, again, that it's something inherent to women, but it was a very good managerial strategy. And the work was structured to be seen as temporary, to be seen as something for young, you know, even middle-class white daughter, as something she could do and, you know, maintain her respectability until she got married. There are no what experts call internal labor markets. There's nowhere to go from there. So there's no incentives to stay in the workforce. And even today, that's still pretty much true. And earnings are relatively flat with not a lot of gains for experience. And so this creates a workforce that's going to be unorganizable, which was the intention. So the labor movement, yes, was, you know, it was really a problem that they were not interested in this labor force, you know, but it was very hard. But it's not fighting women that it's so hard. It's fighting management. And I think that some of the things that persist are certainly also that make it hard is, again, the lack of a sense of community, the lack often of a sense of solidarity in the workplace. Perhaps in these places like these Ivy League universities, it maybe was easier to foster that because there was a feeling that here we are in these really prestigious universities and we are not getting any benefit from that. And in fact, so one of the slogans was, you know, you can't eat prestige.
You're listening to Women's Magazine on KPFA 94.1 FM and online at kpfa.org. I'm Kate Raphael, and I'm speaking with Professor Linda Blum, author of the book Between Feminism and Labor, The Significance of the Movement for Comparable Worth.
But there's different things that have happened, too, because I think that professionals such as myself, I mean, we're responsible for much more of our own clerical mm-hmm. work now that everything is computerized. I mean, this is partly also the kind of shrinking of the clerical sector over time, even though it's still, yes, you're right, it's mm-hmm. still a very large occupation for women. But there has been this kind of relative shrinkage. And then you also have the offshore, you know, the back office work. Some of it has moved offshore, like data entry for, you know, and kind of credit card processing and claims processing and things like that. That also, of course, makes it so much harder to have any kind of organizing attempts.
Well, then I want to look also at sort of the other half of, if I can go back to the title of your book, Between Feminism and Labor, looking at the role that feminism may have played. It's my impression that parts of the women's movement, at least feminists in the labor movement, were very interested in reaching out to office workers in the late 70s and early 80s because they understood that that was where a concentration of women workers were, but that interest kind of faded by the 90s and they moved on to other groups of maybe lower waged workers like retail, hotel and restaurant workers, healthcare workers and mm-hmm. welfare mm-hmm. to work programs. You know, why do you think it was that office workers have kind of fallen off the map? As an office worker, I sometimes get the feeling that a lot of feminists are embarrassed by us because we're not challenging gender stereotypes in our work, uh-huh. and they uh-huh. see us dressing conservatively, wearing high heels and makeup. I mean, not me, but many of my coworkers, you know.
Again, I mean, I think it's also something where it's kind of these exquisite managerial strategies, because women have to look good in these jobs, many of them. It's part of the requirement for the job. And yet it's also this exquisite way to kind of create compliance or create loyalty, to kind of defang any potential challenges, because women, of course, find pleasure in that, in dressing well and enjoying that and so on. Now, I guess on the feminist side, I don't know that there is a the feminist movement, and it's been very tough going in the last two decades. I don't know if I'd go so far as to say this group is embarrassing to feminists, because I think in some ways, there's No, the feminists who are embarrassed. I think there's just such much greater diversity among women's situations now, and a greater diversity of needs and unaddressed needs among different groups of women in the country today. You know, there has certainly been some shift of energy, as you say, to sort of, let's say, the most desperately marginalized groups. There's also been the successes, and so, you know, certainly that quelled some of the fervor or energy, I guess, that we felt in the 70s, and particularly for many of the next generation, because many of my students are surprised to hear that there's still a wage gap. You know, none of them think that they'll ever be single mothers. They don't think about that they might really be the sole breadwinner. I mean, they would like to have good careers, but they don't think in terms of the fact that women's earnings still really don't go that far.
So as you mentioned, both the labor movement and the feminist movement have been under relentless attack for the last 30 years or more. And certainly with the recession, the labor movement has been even more in decline. Only about 13% of workers in this country are now represented by unions, and in the private sector, that rate is only 7%. Do you see any grounds for hope?
Of course. I mean, some of the things that are happening with the Obama administration give me quite a lot of hope. Thus, new healthcare legislation being a big one, because there are so many women workers who lack good healthcare, any kind of health benefits through their work. And all those women who still do office work through temp agencies or who freelance and subcontract and all these kinds of things, like I think women who do like medical transcription often do have kind of freelance operation out of their home. And I think that some of this clerical organizing that was done in universities is doing well, and I think it is spreading. I think that perhaps this economic downturn, it also, I see real changes with my students. What young women have called third wave feminist activism had been very preoccupied with issues we might call Nancy Fraser, who's a feminist theorist, who's wonderful, has called a politics of recognition rather than a politics of redistribution. And so it had, you know, many issues about recognizing, you know, LGBTQ issues, all the work around rights for same-sex families, and recognizing the issues for transgendered peoples, and all of these issues about recognition. And that was a preoccupation I know of many, many of my students, those who did identify strongly as feminists. So very, very far away from needs for economic justice. And I think actually it's a ray of hope to me in this all this economic turmoil and struggle that we're in now, is I think then it raises those issues again, that while we need the politics of recognition, you know, we also need a politics of redistribution, and we do need to move those economic justice issues back to the center of focus. And I think that's just more real now to many young people who have that idealism and that energy to go out and become, you know, activists in, you know, many aspects of their sort of day-to-day lives.
My guest has been Linda Blum. She is professor of sociology at Northeastern University and the author of Between Feminism and Labor, The Significance of the Comparable Worth Movement. Thank you so much, Professor Blum, for taking the time to talk to us on Women's Magazine.